Well, good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. We seem to have lost our opening credits in the limbo, but we're really here. This is a talk show for all of Alaska. It's live on the air on radio stations all across the state, and your calls are welcome. It started with a dream of resurveying the mail trail to the gold mining claims, and it became a full-scale revival of the sport of professional sled dog mushing. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. The subject today is the last great race and whether it should be tamed. What do you think about removing the dangerous Happy River steps? Our number is 1-800-478-8255. That's 478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk at alaskapublic.org. The Iditarod Trail is going to offer adventure no matter how much you try to take the risk out of it. But should we at least try? That's the subject on Talk of Alaska statewide. Well, do we want to run some funding credits here, Dave? All right. Well, then I'll just proceed. It's hard to believe the Iditarod is 40 years old. Iditarod XL 40. It has now been going as long as it wasn't going. You can count it off from the Serum Run of 1925 to when Mayor Dorothy Page was looking for a way to celebrate the Wassilikinik Centennial in 1967. I mean, basically, the Iditarod Trail became a mail trail in the early 1920s. In the mid-20s was the Serum Run. By the late 20s, Bush pilots were doing a lot of that work. So 40 years before Dorothy Page got this idea for 1967, the Iditarod Trail had been dormant. And now it has been alive for 40 years since then. Amazing. So the first runs actually happened in 1967 and again in 1969. And those were just races that couldn't do the whole way to Nome. It wasn't even envisioned that they would do the whole route to Nome. So they don't count. The first one that counts happens in 1973. And the reason it happens is because the Army's a training exercise in 1972, with a lot of prodding from Dorothy Page and Joe Rennington, decided that it was going to survey the entire old trail. And they went out and found it again. You know, after 40 years, they go and find the whole trail. And this includes like all kinds of very remote country, especially in the Innoko, where there is basically nobody living anymore. You know, an occasional cabin here and there, but the town of Iditarod itself, once a gold mining city, is a complete ghost town, and a number of others are real close to it. And so here's this remote country, and here's the military going out and resurveying the trail and making it possible to run an Iditarod in 1973, and they've done it every year since then. So you go and look at the standings for that year, and you find out that Dick Wilmarth won the race in a matter of 20 days. Then you fast forward 39 years to John Baker doing it in 8 days, 18 hours, and 46 minutes yesterday. So there's been an evolution over the 40 years. You'd have to say there's an evolution, and that's what we're talking about, the taming of the Iditarod Trail, the changing of the Iditarod Trail. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. Email us talk at alaskapublic.org. If you're calling from Anchorage, the toll-free number doesn't work. You have to call 550-8422. I know that's a lot of information. But this is a subject that there are probably many who want to talk about, and most specifically, the Happy River Steps. If you are, if you have experience with that, maybe you'd like to call and just talk to us a little bit about what it's like. It's my understanding that usually they try and break the trail as well as they can with snow machines through there, and it's pretty good for the first few teams that go through, but there were these nasty switchbacks, and what would happen is that at any sort of speed at all, the runners would start digging into the snow off to the side, and pretty soon the whole thing would turn into a sugary mess. So the later teams would have more trouble often than the earlier teams, although that would vary from year to year. And certainly there have been many falls and many people, broken bones and concussions and teams getting loose in that area. And it has been a nightmare and something that, you know, mushers talk to one another about. So now, if you're a sled dog musher, what do you make of taking the Happy River steps out of the trail? Because that's what's happened. They've got a mining road in there. There are mining claims, and there's a mining development going on. And so there it was, an easy way to go up the Happy River, no longer using those switchbacks, and the trail committee decided to do it. So the taming of the trail continues. In a sense, there's always been a trend of taming. If you look back on it, I mean, when did they decide to start the race in Anchorage instead of Kinnick? I think it was sometime in the 80s. Then there was the matter of, well, you know, it's kind of a hassle to, and maybe unfair to the mushers, to have the real start in Anchorage, and so they turned it into a ceremonial start. And then this year, they've taken that ceremonial start, and they've shrunk it down. So instead of going all the way out to Eagle River, the teams just go down to Campbell Airstrip for the first time. And the result of all that means that it's not 1,049 miles, if it ever was. It's more like 975 miles. Taming of the trail. So over and over again, we see this happening. And there are certainly other parts of the trail that are problematical. You know, you get the Farewell Burn that everybody talks about with those stumps sticking up. It's hard to imagine that they could find any way to tame that. But, you know, that changes. History changes down through the years. The telephone number here is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. And there's one. Hello? Oh, good. Yeah, sure. So we're ready for your calls, and we are expecting also to hear from Craig Medred, the Alaska Dispatch's. He's actually covering the Iditarod Invitational this year. So he's actually on the trail, and the trail is pretty weird right now because there's been a whole lot of snow up there. I mean, like a couple of feet. And so he reported last night from Yentna, where the Iditarod Invitational people, basically the skiers, are the ones in the lead. The bicycle people have had to just sort of push their bicycles the whole way, and the walkers are holding up rather well. So the bicyclists are really having a problem with the trail this year. And Craig is going to call us from wherever he is out on the trail if he can. Like I said, that could be someplace between Yentna and Squintna and a radio phone or whatever. But we await a call from Craig if he can get through. Meanwhile, let's talk to Stephen Willow. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Steve.
Hello, how you doing?
I'm doing just great. This is a subject that I think really needs to be talked about, especially statewide, so I'm glad to be doing it.
How about you? I really appreciate all the effort you've given forth to bring the subject up. I did hear a show you did maybe 2 or 3 years ago, and I think that show went a different direction. This one, I wanted to bring up the original Serum Run. I hear it's quoted a lot that it has a historical value or some type of, parallel to the Serum Run. Although I see, like, the commercial corporate model today is putting the dogs through a lot more grueling race, since the original dogs, the longest dog only ran 260 miles, and it was also a relay where the mushers worked together and broke trail, and it was a much different event.
And of course, it was from Nanana.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And my whole interest was sparked. We found out my wife's great aunt Gussie was one of the few nurses that actually went from dog sled from Barrow to Nome to try to help with the diphtheria situation. And we found this out a few years ago through relatives, and that kind of sparked my interest in just trying to find out a little bit about the actual history surrounding the event and, where we got to today, per se.
And?
Well, I'm a dog lover, and I wonder where this thing is going. I think 260 miles is a long distance for a dog to run, but I see these commercial dogs running 2,000 miles a year competitively, and I don't know if that's really healthy for the animals.
I see. Yeah. Well, of course, we had an email, as we sort of expected, from Lucy, who said a lot of the same things, but not as diplomatically as you. I mean, she basically thinks that, these dogs love to run. Well, they probably just want to get off their chains. but nonetheless, we have gone into this a number of times, but not really squarely, usually talking about dog performance and all that. And I remember distinctly a show with a veterinarian where he said these dogs seem to be capable of things that we can't even imagine medically. He said, I just play catch up. I go out there and take these measurements and try and figure out how they can do it. So in a sense, I guess, the point that you're making is true, that we're in unknown territory in terms of the well-being of the animals, right?
Correct. And I wonder what a man like Leonard Cipolla, who started the Husky breed, and we use these animals up here for freight hauling and homesteading and gold mining and all these pursuits that were replaced by airplanes and snow machines. And at this point, I just wonder, what's the difference between a Michael Vick case where two animals are fighting to their death and the man is sent to prison, and what's the difference between running a dog to its death, and that could be the outcome of the performance.
So would you turn it into a stage race, or a relay, or if you had your druthers, Steve and Willow, what would you do?
Well, I think there needs to be a lot of transparency here. On my level, I've recently uncovered that all the drop dogs are sent to a prison, outside of Anchorage, from what I understand.
Oh, and I would hardly call it a prison. I've seen it. I wouldn't really call it a prison. I mean, just in fairness.
Okay. Well, then I may not be correct on that. But I just think there needs to be transparency. If the dogs are that injured and that's really going on, I think everyone should know about it. And I think if a lot of the dogs don't make it a year after the race, people should also know about that so that Alaskans can form an honest opinion based on the truth surrounding the event.
Steve, I want to thank you so much for your call and for being so diplomatic about it.
Well, Steve, I also want to thank you for doing all the work you do and bringing this great show to us up here. This is really good for our community.
All right. Thanks a lot. Next caller is from Willow. Dee Dee Johnro, you're still in Willow, or are you in Anchorage?
No, I'm in Willow, and I suspect I don't live too far from Steve, and I'm truthfully sorry that the man hasn't done more research on the quality of life of these dogs.
Well, yes. Tell me. Yeah, I would assume that you would not agree with him, and that you have nothing but the highest concern for your dogs.
And So, I've dedicated 35 years of my life and my total finances to quality of life and mental stimulation and increasing the quality of food that's available and care that's available for these dogs. And I would invite Steve to come over and meet my 27 retired dogs up to the age of 17 that are currently living at the kennel. More retired dogs than I have young dogs. I have a roadhouse that I built for the dogs where they can sleep inside as well as outside depending on the temperatures available to them, based on the spirit of the early days when dogs ran from roadhouse to roadhouse and were offered shelter inside. He's talking about the serum run being a relay. However, I don't know what he knows about the early mail trail teams that did travel the entire distance. In fact, I know many friends of mine who carried the mail, and it would take them 3 months with the same dogs to travel from the Kuskokwim up over the Iditarod Trail down to Squintna, where they would pick up the mail and then deliver it back on their way all the way to Bethel. And those were the original dogs that ran the entire thing. And so, you know, the idea that dogs never ran more than about 200 miles is really not historically correct.
Well, Dee Dee, it sounds like you're really giving us some of the transparency that Steve was diplomatically asking for. I mean, I think his feelings were clear, and you're basically clearing some things up. And it seems like there's quite a bit that you know needs to be cleared up, but from what you told us, it's just there are some misperceptions out there.
Well, one of the things that you know is Steve and I share, and that is a concern for and love for dogs. And you know, I can just tell by the questions that he asked that he is concerned about them. And you know, I have to say that I share that quality of life that I want our dogs to all enjoy. And so, you know, from that reason, we're coming, and I'm sure we can meet common ground because we have that same innate love for the animals that we are working with. You know, one thing I would say is if you are curious about, like, the quality of life for these dogs, you know, look and see the leaders that are there year after year, or the team dogs, for instance, that are racing year after year after year. If they weren't physically sound and if they were being pushed beyond their natural God-given abilities, you wouldn't see them with careers as racing dogs. You would see them maybe in a team for a year or two, and then they would be retired or moved, you know, into another home. But that's not the case with those of us with our major teams. You know, I'm running full litters where every dog has made the team, and not only made the team for a year, but like my Pokemons, they're making the team for the 8th year.
Pokemons? And, did you say Pokemons?
My Pokemon litter was named by my niece, and all 7 of them have made the team, and every year they're in the team. This year, Omnistar is, again, one of my main leaders. Some of them have been retired and are training the young dogs now, but my E-litter as well, dogs that begin with the letter E, all of those dogs have made the team for years and years. You know, I have full, I mean, that's my goal. This year I have the V litter coming on as a 2.5-year-old. All 4 of the puppies that were born are all 4 in the team. And, you know, that's the kind of genetic integrity that those of us that have been in the sport for years have dedicated our lives to. That's our goal. It's dogs that are gifted at this and that are able to reproduce themselves and that are able to make long-term careers. And the only way that can happen is because we're dedicated to not only, I'd love for Steve to see my vet bill. I'd love to know how much money he puts in a vet bill as opposed to how much money I put into a vet bill, because I put thousands and thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of dollars in the vet bill. And, you know, that's the kind of dedication that you have to have in order to have dogs that are in the team for, usually I retire them out of my team at about 9 or 10 and have them in the kennel. Their average lifetime would be, the oldest dog I've ever had is 18, but generally 15 is about the average age on my dogs.
Wow. That's really interesting to kind of keep family values and pack values in your teams. That's very, very interesting, Dee Dee. I want to thank you for calling you, and I want to and springing to the defense of the sport, but also I want to ask you what you think about taking the Happy River Steps out of the trail.
Well, to me, that's just another example of good dog care. You know, once another safer route became available, the trail committee took it. And I think that, you know, it wasn't available until a year or two ago. And once they became aware of it, they took it for the safety of the dogs. And it seems like, as opposed to dumbing down the trail, as some people have liked to say, it continues to put the safety of the dogs first. And I got to tell you, this is not, it was advertised as 1,049, but it was more appropriately 1,120 some on the southern route and 1,200 and some on the northern route. And now those, you know, we might actually, taking the steps out is adding 1.5 miles, by the way, not reducing the mileage on it. And, you know, the thing that, over the years, for instance, the trail and the burn, I've run this. I'll be starting my 30th race. So I've run all but 10 Iditarods, so I think I can speak with some authority on this. And, you know, the Farewell Burn is, we used to run it from Rhone River over to Farewell Station, have a checkpoint there, and then over to Rhone, or over to Nikolai. So now we run straight across. Well, then, of course, the trail changed a few years ago when a whole side of a mountain gave way and the landslide covered the trail, and we had to create a new trail around that. And then, of course, every time there's a forest fire, which there was a few years ago, and, of course, we call it the burn because of the original forest fire back in 78, you know, the trail's constantly evolving just like Alaska is, you know. The environment changes every year, and something changes on the trail. And I wouldn't really say it's being made into a fast race course. You can probably talk to the Iditasport people about that.
Boy, especially this year. Yeah, well, you know, I'm sure you know, because you would be clued into the committee, but... one of the reasons that Donlin Creek signed on as a sponsor, a major sponsor of the Iditarod, is because of their interest in getting a power line over Rainy Pass at some point to get power to their mine. Now that could really smooth out that part of the trail, don't you think?
Well, they're talking about doing it as a tunnel. So I don't know. I don't think they're going to be tunneling the dogs through.
No, I doubt that. But that's kind of an interesting thought.
So I think there's a lot more that's unknown at this point about that, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not seeing a paved highway to Nome, I can tell you that.
Right. So Dee Dee Genro, I want to thank you for calling in and helping move our show along.
Okay, thank you so much for your interest.
Yeah, anything you want to add?
Well, no, just that I'm looking forward to getting back out on the trail with, you know, my team. This year I have two teams out there, Janie Kinzer and myself, and, you know, we're putting 36 dogs on the trail that have been through their ECGs and all their blood work, and looking forward to a nice, safe race to Nome.
Yeah, there's a lot of deep snow, I guess, this side of the Alaska Range. I would think that could slow things down a bit.
I just got 36 inches of it, so... I know what you're telling me.
All right, well, let's hope they get it beat down in time for the race.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
All right, Dee Dee, thank you so much for calling. It's Talk of Alaska, the telephone number 1-800-478-8255, Anchorage number 550-8422. Email is talk@alaskapublic.org, and we'll go to Bjorn in Homer in a moment. But first, this one from Larry says, ultimately, what kind of race is the Iditarod? Compare the Indianapolis 500 to the Baja 500. If you want to make this a survival race rather than a timed race, keep the dangerous portions. Make up your mind and pick one or have two. One, a well-groomed flat highway with warming huts and catered dog food every 50 miles, and the other exactly as the Serum Run had with the equipment technology limited to what was available in 1925. Maybe even have it a relay race instead of a single dog team running the whole way. Sand traps, obstacles, and difficult terrain is fine for golf courses. Danger to life and limb is minimal. Or on a race such as the Iditarod, it makes sense to wimp out. As long as the competitive nature of the race is even, cleaning up the race course does not diminish the race itself. Risking dogs and human lives in the name of sport is a moral decision. And while we're at it, what's with mouth guards and gloves for boxers or helmets for football players? That from Larry in Anchorage. I love it when people put so much thought. They make the whole show. Let's go to Bjorn Jones, the program from Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Bjorn.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me. Can I say first that I just absolutely adore Dee Dee Genro?
She's kind of a sweetheart, let's face it.
I love her so much. We actually had an opportunity to interview her at the Tasmania 200 last winter before the Iditarod, as a part of a documentary project we're working on about Donlin Gold. My partner and I did an 850-mile expedition starting in Knik and ending in Bethel, which we kind of assumed was the footprint of the Donlin Gold project. And so we rode our bikes right behind the Iditarod race last year to McGrath, and along the way interviewed people on this topic that we're having the discussion of right now. And, you know, it was a real interesting conversation to have with trail users and, you know, residents of the area. You know, and we were actually unaware until we got there about this new Happy Valley cutout for this Whistler Mine project that's going in up the back of the Skwentna. But we decided to follow it, and then looking at the map that they have released for the pipeline route for Donlin, it shows that, you know, it would kind of tie right into that road and then go up the Happy over the Alaska Range, over Rainy Pass, and then out the Farewell through Roan and all that. And, you know, we just wanted to get a feel, you know, as a part of this documentary project of, you know, what people thought about kind of the industrialization of the Alaskan wilderness. And it was, you know, just about as interesting as this show, you know, a real mixed bag of opinions that people had.
But, well, you know, it's so interesting, you know, moving, you know, growing up on the East Coast where everything is, it goes back hundreds of years, and moving to Alaska where, you know, you can still shake hands with some of the people that wrote the Constitution. You know, we are in such a young state that sometimes we don't realize our history is unveiling every day.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and then the question is, you know, which of us, you know, feel strongly about preserving it, and which of us are kind of on the, you know, the path of, you know, maybe gentrifying more of the wilderness, or, you know, making convenience more of a priority. You know, so that's kind of what we're feeling out about this, you know, within this documentary, and, you know, hope to have it out this this fall. It's a project with Ground Truth Trekking, which, you know, looks at a lot of these natural resource issues in Alaska and tries to open the, you know, the dialogue on the, you know, on the greater discussions.
Yeah, well, they're it's an awful lot of country, Bjorn, ain't it?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, 850 miles, and, you know, so much of it, we felt like we were just in the middle of truly nowhere, you know. It was an amazing experience, and a lot of great, you know, a lot of great people along the way that are, you know, very engaged in this conversation, that have a lot to say, and, you know, kind of have maybe, I think the Pebble, you know, conversation has taken a lot of the thunder from this one. But when you get out into these communities, you know, people know about what's coming down the pike for them and are, you know, pretty opinionated one way or the other. So that's our hope, is to, you know, get a little more attention about this issue, and, you know, broaden the conversation a bit.
All right, Bjorn, well, I want to thank you for your call. Can't argue with Ground Truth, and especially not on this
Great.
Show.
Yeah,
it's Talk of Alaska, and we're talking about the taming of the Iditarod Trail. I think about the, there's a point where the race really gets interesting. Well, I'll say after Takotna, maybe. Whether it is this north or south route going to Ophir and in there, where often there can be like immense snowfall, and it's quite a long stretch for people to get out there and get trail broken with the with snow machines. They did improve the markers, I guess, last year, and but nonetheless, there are difficulties in that part of the trail. People get lost. There can be really deep snow, and people can get bogged down. You can get one team comes through blasting, and another team can take almost a day. And then when they go the southern route, it continues. Essentially, they put this one spot. Let's see. If it goes north, it's Cripple, and if it goes south, it's Iditarod. And they have to pretty well kind of erect a way station there for the teams, checkpoint and so forth. And then after that, on the southern route, things get really quite remote and quite dangerous. And there have been some very, you know, life-threatening situations there. Dogs have died of the cold and exposure in that area. I don't know. Can you tame that? I'm kind of wondering. I kind of don't think it would take an awful lot, really, to tame that. But maybe it could be. You could build something there that would make things a little safer, a refuge of some sort. Anyway, it's not a simple situation, as we're hearing, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state governments since 1991. On the web at akbudgetreport.com.
Talk of Alaska, and we're talking about the possible taming of the Iditarod Trail. So far, the callers are saying, yeah, it's good to take the Happy River Steps out. What do you think? 1-800-478-8255. Some are saying for the sake of the dogs. Some are saying for the sake of safety. And a number are saying, well, we have a situation where it's really never stayed static. It's been, in all its 40 years, it's always been changing. The technology that is used changes. The standards of dog care change. Public perceptions change. And the sport changes. I mean, basically, if you... we didn't used to have full-time sled dog people, and we do now. We've got professionals. We've got, you know, it takes a lot more money to run the trail than it once did. And to be competitive. We've got a situation now where some of the people who run slower in the Iditarod, it's almost like sometimes it's been brought up, well, maybe there should be a separate category for them because there's a whole network of volunteers and so forth that, you know, gets ready to pull up stakes and we're still waiting for a few laggards there at the end of the race. You always got to have a sweeper at the end to kind of hustle them along, and they've put standards in place so that people don't just lollygag and enjoy themselves along the way. And maybe that's not so good. I mean, maybe they should be able to lollygag and just take a bit more risk. 1-800-478-8255 is the telephone number. 1-800-478-TALK. A local call from Anchorage at 550-8422. We're hoping and expecting to hear from Craig Medred, who is out on the trail covering the Invitational, which has been an interesting situation because of all the snow. Dee Dee John Rowan Willow said that there she'd seen over a foot. And the snow is so bad that it's just out of the question for the fat tire bicycle people to stay on top of it. They just have to dismount. The skiers are really kind of leading the Invitational right now. Bicycle's a liability. The walkers are are doing better. They've got snowshoes with them. 1-800-478-8255, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk at alaskapublic.org. So we've had as much as 100 teams in the race. The first race they had 22. So I guess, you know, that narrative is fairly persuasive that the Iditarod has always been changing. We've had several calls on the, you know, questioning whether this is really the best thing for the animals. Let's go to Darla, joins the program from Knik. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Darla.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to add a few points to Dee's talk. I'm a recreational muster. We have about 25 dogs, half of which are retired. And, of course, for dog care, I just want to say that, you know, a lot of these Iditarod dogs go through many vet checks, often sometimes more than many home pets may go through. They're very well taken care of. And they're very different animals than they were back when the serum ran. They're bred for endurance and speed. There are studies done on these dogs about their athleticism. And so there's really a lot of focus on dog care. I don't really know. I've never done the Iditarod, so I don't really know about your main question, but I just kind of wanted to throw out a couple things about the dog.
Yeah, well, and I think anybody that actually watches the dogs, I mean, Dee Dee made a couple of great points, but, you know, it's really hard to imagine that they're not enjoying it.
Yeah, my dogs absolutely love it, and I know that any other dogs I've seen, and, you know, a few bad apples tend to ruin the whole bunch.
Yeah. So that's a pretty sizable kennel for being a recreational musher.
Well, we've got a lot of retired dogs. We still want to run. We only have about 12 that run, and so the rest live in the yard.
I couldn't believe when Dee Dee was telling me how many retired dogs she's got. I mean, this is really interesting.
Yeah, we have 10 that actually live in our house. So a lot of mushers do this sort of thing, kind of give up their home and life to these dogs. You know,
because
they care about dogs.
Well, yeah, it is. I mean, you see that, and there's also, you know, I remember bringing this up years ago with Ed Eaton and Ellie Zirkel about going pro, and just this idea that there comes a point where this is really all you want to do. When you're not doing it, you're thinking about it.
Yeah, exactly.
I just, you know, so it is, and also I think there is a, you know, there's probably a long-term relationship between humans and dogs that goes way, 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 way back. I mean, back before you know, speech and, you know, I mean, just a long, long time.
Yeah, man's best friend.
Yeah. Well, Darla, I want to thank you so much for calling and giving us the viewpoint of a recreational musher.
Thank you.
All right. It's Talk of Alaska, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. Email is talk@alaskapublic.org, and it's a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. I'm trying to imagine what Joe Reddington would have said about taking the Happy River steps out of the trail. And somehow I really think that, I don't know, I mean, we can't really channel Joe Reddington, but still, you know, I'm just wondering what it would have been, what he would have said, because it's a early challenge. I mean, the way I have seen it down through the years, this is the point at which sometimes before that, where the rookies realize that they're getting a test, and that this is some serious business, and where maybe there's some things that the veteran mushers tend to have less problem with this because they've encountered it before and they learn some things. And now all that lore about the steps goes away. And we heard from Dee Dee Jonrell that, as far as she's concerned, great. You know, it makes it better for the dogs. It's always been dangerous and difficult, and they made the right decision. What do you think? There could be more decisions of the same nature, you know. A power line going across Rainy Pass maybe could straighten out a few more places for the Iditarod Trail, which is now well below 1,049 miles. 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call from Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. And Dale joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Dale.
Thank you, and as usual, it's another excellent show, and I get, you know, especially excited when it's about the Iditarod. It's dear to my heart.
Now, man, I'm telling you, these shows always come out interesting. I don't know why, but it just there's so much to talk about and so much to learn, and it is, you know, as I've just sort of come to realize during this show today, it changes every year, really.
Oh, absolutely, and I to kind of go in reverse order of what I wanted to address, I think with most old timers, if they didn't do it the way that I did it, then they're doing they're taking the easy way out in regards to the trail alterations. But, you know, it's progress. The sleds are entirely different. The clothing's entirely different. The animals are entirely different than when it first began. And so it's progress, but it's one of those things where all us old guys sit around and say, well, yeah, but that's, you know, they don't have to go through the trial and error of the steps. And it is better for the dogs and safer for the mushers in the long run. So that's the primary plus for the whole thing. The other thing, and I was trying to get on the phone when Dee Dee called to respond to Steve, you know, he mentioned openness, and man, I tell you, there is so much information that he would drown in all the information that's available about the dog care, and the head vet, Stu Nelson, Dr. Stu Nelson, he's renowned throughout the world for advances in dog nutrition, dog care, dog, you know, overall health, everything. And every year there are vets from foreign countries that come to work just to see the operation and see how the dogs perform.
Oh, this is one of the big highlights. I mean, this is a big deal. If you're a veterinarian, especially dealing with canines, boy, you want to do the Iditarod.
Oh, absolutely. These people, you know, some of them pay their own expenses and give up their vacation time, and it's not a cheap thing to do.
No.
Well, you know.
And, we all know that.
There's just such care and concern about the welfare of these animals. They live better than a lot of people do in this country. And as far as their health is concerned and their exercise, these are marathon. You know, if they were humans, they'd be ultra triathletes. And these animals are just incredible. But they're not. If any animal gets to the point where it is hurting or there's a problem, you cannot make a dog run. You know, you just can't.
So how long, Dale, have you been volunteering?
I volunteered for 22 years, and then 1 year in 96, I did the Iditarod Challenge, which Joe Reddington did for 5 years, which is, they used to call it the Yuppie Iditarod, because we took off the day after the race started. And we followed the same trail, same checkpoints, same everything, but we were not racing. And it took us about 21 days to get to Nome. And
oh, man, does that sound great?
Oh, it was I've had a very exciting life, but it was the highlight of my life.
Wait, of course, yeah, of course, there's no purse waiting for you at the end if you win.
Well, no, we got a nice photograph under the arch.
All right.
So, but it was just an incredible experience. And then you really come to understand what these dogs are all about when you actually work with one on the trail. And so it was a great experience. But I enjoy your shows. I learn something every time. I especially enjoy the Iditarod focus shows. So thank you very much.
All right. Yeah. Thank you so much, Iditarod volunteer Dale, who also volunteer for that slower run that Joe Reddington had, that recreational run. Man, does that sound good. Well, I'm looking at my race finishers and seeing that the first year that Rick Swenson won the race was 1977. 1977. He's still running this year. Also running this year, and the person who I should have invited to come on now, I realize, is Dan Seavey, who's become known as the ambassador of the Iditarod, and he's actually running the race this year. So I guess we've got three generations of CV in the race this year. I couldn't believe it when I saw his name on there. Dan Seavey's actually going to run the Iditarod? But now I see the committee is sponsoring him as a goodwill musher in the race. And I'm wondering where he's going to finish. Is he going to carry the Red Lantern, Dan Seavey? What do you think? 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
It's Talk of Alaska, and we're talking about taming the Iditarod Trail. Is it a good idea? So far, everybody's saying yes. I'm amazed. 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK. A local call from Anchorage at 550-8422. A couple of web tips. Earlier on the show, we heard from Dee Dee Jonro, and I neglected to mention that on our website, alaskapublic.org, there is some really interesting video of Dee Dee and her lead dog, I believe. And that's on the website right now. Also from the web-based publication, the Alaska Dispatch, where Craig Medred was going to be joining us, except that he can't. We hear from his editor that that Craig is probably not where he can get at a phone. What has happened is that he's covering the Iditarod Invitational, and those people have been facing severe adversity because of the huge amount of snow that has fallen on the trail, with the result that the bicycle people in particular are really hampered. But he did tell his editor, and his editor, Eric, passed on to us that he got a text from Craig, who said that the trail is now finally setting up. It got a little cold, so the bikers can finally get on their bikes, and it's been cooling down and had stopped snowing when he texted this morning. And Craig should be on his way to Rainy Pass and just probably not where he can call us. And so those are my tips. Telephone number 1-800-478-8255. We're talking about taming the Iditarod Trail. And, you know, it is always changing, but is it one of these situations where it comes to a certain point where you say, okay, this is too much. This is taking the wildness out of it. This is taking the challenge out of it. I mean, if it just comes to a matter where it's just a competition between, it's been brought up a number of times that really maybe at some point it just has to go to a staged race. I think probably if you took a poll among Alaskans, they wouldn't like that. Some would, though, I'm sure. But where is the stage where you're taming it too much, or have they already tamed it too much by taking the Happy River steps off? So far, nobody has called up to say, yeah, you know, that it should be challenging. They shouldn't be taking these challenges out of it. The one competitive musher that we spoke with, and she's very competitive, is Dee Dee Jonro. And you would think that the steps would give a veteran musher who will tend to go through there earlier before it gets all squishy, and who would tend to, you know, this might be discourage the competition, and that would be to her advantage. But she said, look, it's safer for the dogs. They had this possibility. They looked at it. They thought about it. They debated it. They decided to do it, and I support it. And there it is. And so it has been with a number of our callers, the ones that, well, a lot of which wanted to call up and defend the race and the issue of dog care. And I don't know if we ever get anywhere on that discussion. It just seems like it's polarized. If you feel that things are being hidden and that we're not getting the whole truth about the condition and treatment of these dogs, we're not going to say anything on this show that's going to change your mind. And yet there are clearly people who feel very strongly exactly the opposite way, extremely supportive of the race, and think that the dogs get the very, very best of care, and there is nothing to hide. Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, if you'd like to join our conversation here. Statewide on Talk of Alaska, we've had a lot of different areas that we've covered down through the years about the Iditarod, the historical nature of the trail, the challenge to the dogs, and what are the real performance frontiers that sled dogs, where are they? Where are their limits? And we don't seem to know what their limits are. We saw situations where especially when the Robert Sorley and could easily have been other Norwegians started winning the race with a different approach to their teams, where they were almost dog psychologists, and they took much longer runs. And Lance Mackey at one point realized, no, actually, I can run longer. My dogs can run longer. They want to run longer. Telephone number 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. I mean, there's always been this trade-off for teams where if you skip rest, you might have to pay for that later on in a reluctance of the team. There does come a point where your dogs don't want to go. It can, and it has for many. Jay joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Jay.
Yes, sir. Yeah, I just want to say that I've been associated with the Iditarod in the past as a dog handler.
Yeah.
I enjoy it. I think it's a wonderful race. I think it's one of Alaska's best legacies, and I'm proud of it. I think they treat their dogs great. I think they're athletes. They're born to do what they're doing. And I'm just proud to be associated with Alaska and the Iditarod.
Great.
It's a great, great legacy. And I send all the information back to my granddaughters in Michigan, and they follow the race in the Upper Peninsula and around the northern part of Michigan. And fans all over the world are want to be a part of it.
So why did you... Why did you, I mean, obviously you like it, but what propelled you to actually take the step of going ahead and being a dog handler?
Well, it's just fun to be around. It's like our Super Bowl, and to be a part of it is a great deal of joy and fun.
It's like our Super Bowl. I love that.
Yeah, it's Alaska Super Bowl. It's a great event. And the carnival in the pre-race down in Anchorage, it's just our carnival. It's our party to set them off. Who cares how long it is? It's the most grueling, toughest race in the world. You know, so it's just a great event.
Yeah, so I take it you'll be on 4th Avenue on Saturday?
Oh, I'll be around all around. I'll be moving all around the race in Anchorage, yeah.
All right, Jay, thanks a lot. I love that. It's our Super Bowl.
You bet.
Let's go to Katie, joins the program from Chickaloon. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Katie.
Good morning.
Morning.
From Chickaloon.
Yeah.
I'm the organizer of the Iditarod Trail Invitational, and our race started on Sunday.
What a crazy situation. Did you hear I had a message from Craig on the trail just by text saying that it's set up a bit now?
Yeah, it has set up a bit now. Yeah, we've been monitoring the race here from Chickaloon, and it's a tough year out there. I think it's been 11 years since the runners got ahead of the bikers at this point in the race. This section of the course is usually super fast. It's usually a snow machine highway. It's a recreational area. There's a lot of lodges. Last year, the bikers, they would have been in Pantilla by now. They can get to Pantilla within 24 hours. In a good year.
Yeah.
But well, it's been very tough. I think there was 30 inches of new snow in some places.
Yeah.
And, of course, there was no trail. And now we're hearing that the wind is blowing out there, so the trails that are now setting up are blowing in again. I've also done the race myself 3 times, twice to McGrath and once to Nome. And I think it's an incredible challenge. We draw competitors from all over the world. The McGrath race, this is the 15th year of this one happening. I think it's an incredible challenge, and it's also an incredible adventure. And I think the weather challenge and winds and getting more snow, it's all part of the challenge. And our particular, the recent changes about taking the steps out, I was a little bit sad to hear that, and I think we're hoping to put in that route for our racers every year, because I think this section of trails should not be missed. It's one of my favorites.
Ah.
To go up the Happy River Steps, I have pushed my bike up these really steep hills, and I have tried to figure out how to even get down those hills with my bike. Sometimes, you know, you don't want to crash with the bike and hurt yourself or break the bike, so it's been a challenge, but it's also been really interesting figuring out how to overcome that challenge.
I guess also, you know, if they found a way around the gorge, you probably wouldn't like that either.
No. The Dalsdale Gorge is spectacular. There's sometimes the ice bridges are bad. I have carried my bike through creek crossings, but it's a spectacular section of trail, and it's a challenge. And like I said, overcoming the challenge is what makes it a great race to me.
Well, Katie, I want to thank you for calling. I mean, I almost feel like I'm out there without getting tired.
I'm really impressed with our competitors. I think we have 10 scratches so far out of 49 that started on Sunday. And I'm really impressed with the people that are pushing on and they continuing up the trail. We got a very strong field of racers this year.
So how many, can you give me a breakdown of how many are runners, how many are skiers, how many are on bikes?
We this is a winter event, and we historically we have very few skiers, but they're doing extremely well right now, especially because of the warm temperatures. We have two skiers, and we have, I believe we have at least 15 runners, and the rest, so that makes 17. That would leave 10 to 15 bikers left in the event.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Well, hey, I look forward to seeing how everybody comes out, and thanks so much for your work on that, Katie.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on the show.
Yeah, that's great. So we heard from Katie, who's running the she is administering the Invitational this year, and I want to thank everybody who called up and to talk about the Iditarod. Some attacked, some defended, most felt that it was not a bad idea to take some of the risk out of the Iditarod Trail. There's plenty more to come and plenty more challenge. Next week on Talk of Alaska, we'll be talking about agriculture, growing stuff in Alaska again. Thanks to Josh Edge and thanks to Dave Waldron. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Wells Fargo, committed to supporting communities and Alaska residents beyond just their banking needs. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at Primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory. Enjoy high school hoops in Anchorage during the 2012 ASAA March Madness State Basketball Championships, March 12th through 17th. Come early and stay late to enjoy Anchorage's big wildlife with events, shopping, dining, and activities for the whole family. For more information on what to see and do in Anchorage, explore anchorage.net/Alaskans, your source for Anchorage information. This message sponsored by Visit Anchorage. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.